Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Tonight, the regular CrimeWire team are all absent for various reasons, and manning the show tonight is myself, Kim Colton, CrimeWire Director of Research. Tonight's special guest is Peter Hyatt. Welcome, Peter.
Kim, thanks for having me on.
Now, tonight we are highlighting the Charlie Rogers case. I'll just read this for our listeners. On Sunday, July 22nd, three masked men allegedly broke into the Lincoln, Nebraska home of Charlie Rogers, bound her wrists and ankles with zip ties, beat her, and carved anti-gay slurs into her arms and abdomen. The men also allegedly spray-painted a derogatory term for lesbians inside the home and tried to set it on fire, and what police are investigating as a hate crime. Rogers told police she was targeted because she's gay, but some are questioning the veracity of Rogers' accounts of the attack. Charlie Rogers said that three masked men broke into her home, tied her up, scrawled anti-homosexual graffiti into her skin, and wrote vile things upon her walls, as well as set her house on fire after pouring gasoline on it. The outpouring of support has been strong, including prayer vigils being organized, as well as mobilization of various political and rights groups. It is a big story of a hateful and vicious attack. Police have not found the three men who Rogers say attacked her, but authorities are treating it as a hate crime. She went public, she says, to counter and confront those who doubt her story. And Peter, tell us a little bit about this. What's your take on this and so forth?
Well, it's actually quite a journey that listeners can go on with us as we dissect this case. We have a report given to the local police in Lincoln, Nebraska, of a horrific crime. I had written an article on it that it really bordered on a Nazi-like description, where the three perpetrators who broke into her home did so in the early morning hours, found her in her bed, dragged her out of her bed, tied her with zip ties, obviously subdued her, beat her, carved the epitaph into her, I believe, her abdomen and her arm, then spray-painted more slurs in the basement, poured gasoline around the house, and lit it on fire. She then was able to escape and was bleeding profusely and crying and made it to a neighbor's home, and where they called 911. And so the magnitude of such a crime is that these three men who were wearing masks are on the loose. And they not only would she suffer the trauma of a home invasion, she would suffer the trauma of a violent assault, but the sadistic nature of literally carving into someone's flesh, this is where I got the Nazi-like comparison of someone that is just so explicitly evil as to be able to subdue her, hold her down, then take a knife and begin to carve into the flesh. This horrified everyone that heard it. It was just one of the most vicious types of attacks. But to enter into the story, we must consider that she would be then likely held down by two while she's kicking and screaming and squirming and fighting, while one was carving these things into her flesh. So these three men that are alleged to have done this, these should be considered very dangerous, very twisted, and literally men that would enjoy inflicting pain upon another. So it's about the worst crime outside of murder that you can think about, because it involves pain, it involves some severe hatred, and it involves men that are on the loose now. So really, everyone that lives in that community should be just terrified, and people responded with that type of terror and outrage. What happened from there is where it gets interesting. No one in any media anywhere, and I researched this carefully, I was on vacation, I had lots of free time, no one in media anywhere challenged her story. In fact, in a few of the newspapers, perhaps one line was donated to this, where it said the police would also be making sure this was not a hoax or self-inflicted injury to draw attention to her cause, homosexual rights cause, that sort of thing. There is some things going on in that area. But there was no challenge. No one said that she wasn't telling the truth. No one challenged the veracity. And this is where I think it gets so interesting for listeners. She then decided, because police did not release her name, she was asked if she wanted to speak to the FBI, because this is now a federal crime, a hate crime, and which makes it interesting because everything ups the ante when it goes from the local level to the federal level. For instance, if it's a false report, it's a misdemeanor. If it's a false report to a federal investigator, it's a felony. So it ups the level, and she agreed, and I believe she spoke to the FBI. And she decided to come forward, the media said, on television, to tell people that she was telling the truth about what happened. This is what media said that was the purpose of it. And the entire video of her speaking is about 5 minutes in length. The response, and this is where I think it gets most interesting, the response from the public was an overwhelming amount of support. There were candlelight vigils, politicians got involved, protests, events that are being planned, fundraising. In fact, her lawyer set up a special fund for her that people could donate to. And across our nation, people responded with a tremendous outpouring of love and support for her.
Mm-hmm.
The five-minute video where she's speaking, to the purpose of it was to assert that she was telling the truth. I did the work of a statement analyst. I did statement analysis upon that transcript. And what I found was that there was no linguistic connection between her words and the horrific event that police have described that said what happened. In other words, when she spoke, she wasn't speaking from experiential memory. Memory was not playing as she spoke. This same five-minute video, the analysis, I think I put about 45 minutes per minute to work in. So it took about 3 or 4 hours to complete. But this entire five-minute video that was seen by the country, and this is where I think it gets interesting for listeners, everywhere people acclaimed it to be true. In fact, I was not able to find in all the research I could do and others were doing for me a single article anywhere that challenged the veracity of it, which was really surprising to me, because generally when someone reports a bizarre or horrific crime, everyone is left with an opinion. You can either believe what you've heard or you can disbelieve it, but you will have an opinion. And it doesn't mean that you're judging her or you're judging her sexuality. It doesn't mean any of those things. It means you simply believe her or you don't believe her, or somewhere in the middle you say, I'm not sure if I believe her, and you have doubts. What I did was I say, I don't believe her, and here, which I submitted to the police, here is the reasons why I don't believe her. So I'm able to offer proofs of why I believe it's not true. Her lawyer, interesting enough, has withheld the funds from her. even though she supposedly lost her job or her business because of the injuries and the trauma that she suffered, the lawyer has decided not to release the money until the police investigation is through. Which I think that's kind of, exactly. That should be the response.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So what I'm offering to listeners is they can decide if A, I'm nuts, or B, everyone else is wrong. So I don't like being in the position where, I'm the only one right here. Everyone else is wrong. That's kind of a crazy place to be. But In the usual world of crime coverage, including statement analysis, body language analysis, behavioral analysis, and overall criminal analysis, I found no one anywhere for the entire first week who did any analysis of this case. So I myself and others began to search, and my question was, is anyone asking if this thing is true or not, if this really happened? Because if it did, we have three vicious killers who attempted to kill her by setting the house on fire with pouring gasoline on the loose, or we have a really felonious and hideous report to promote an agenda that she has. And so it allows everyone to say, okay, I feel like someone's telling the truth, or I feel like someone's not telling the truth. I'm giving the reasons why. I state probably 16 or 17 reasons why I say she's not telling the truth. But I was not able to find anywhere that challenge. I found one body language analysis that raised red flags, but realistically, I'm not a body language expert, but I have been cut up by a knife before, and the pain is extreme. The pain, when it starts to heal, becomes more extreme. It itches over. It's horrible. And body language-wise, when she's sitting in front of the camera, she's able to sit but looks to be fairly comfortable. And my own personal opinion of the body language is that the body language itself is showing deception, and she doesn't even appear to be in discomfort a few days after the attack.
And Peter, let's just, one thing that you had touched on was that victims of violent attacks often talk about things they sensed through sight, smell, or touch.
Yes.
And that signals that someone is entering into an experimental memory and being truthful. And then you give some examples. Can you give some of those examples?
Sure. We have a rape case that seems to be utterly implausible. It's just no one's believing it. But the victim talks about the smell of motor oil on the assailant's hands. That's a signal for us that the truth is, that the memory is playing and the truth is being told, because we all are creatures of sense. And if we are either older than the age of three, or an adult with intellectual disabilities has a functioning above a 3 or 4 year old, that person will be able to communicate something with the senses, the way the knife felt against the skin, the breath of the assailant that was so close to her. Those types of things are just commonly found in truthful statements. For instance, when I smell chlorine water at a pool, it brings me back to community pool swimming 30 years ago as a young boy.
Yeah.
So it's that type of memory that was not evident. But what we do, and this is really a fascinating part of analysis, is we presuppose what someone would say. For instance, if I said that you had, before the show, driven over to my house, broken into my house, stolen my money, and driven back and made it back in time for the show, before we say much else, you're probably going to say to me, I didn't do that. What's wrong with you? You're kind of crazy. But you will tell me that you didn't do it. So what we do is we presuppose that what people will talk about in the event. Do you remember the case of Isabel Chellis, the 6-year-old that was alleged to get kidnapped in Arizona? Okay.
Yes, Arizona.
Yep. When her parents went on television, finally their child was missing, and the father had made the 911 call. I think most of your listeners are familiar with it, because he chuckled on the 911 call.
Yes, he said, did.
Yeah, hello, we have an abduction, a person, a missing person, a person's been abducted. When they refused to speak to the media, which is a terrible red flag, because if someone is taking your child, the first thing that a parent does is reach out to the child verbally. It's just, it's natural. It's like a child lost in Walmart or a child lost in the woods. The first thing is going to be a cry out to the child. And the second word out of the parent's mouth is going to be, what do you want that I can get her back? Well, Isabel and Sergio Chelis refused to leave their house. Mm-hmm. And this went on for almost a week with the police pleaded with them, and they arranged it for media, and the police began to scratch their heads going, why won't these people speak to media? Mm-hmm. When they finally spoke and gave a full interview on media, question and answers, what was expected from them were words like abduction and ransom and things like that. That's kind of the expected. In the interview, they never spoke of any of those things. They never mentioned the word kidnapping, never mentioned the word abduction, never mentioned the word ransom, never mentioned any of those things. Oh, they talked a lot about hope, or they talked about this or that, but none of the things you would expect.
Right.
So if we have someone who is going to talk to us to affirm that they've told the truth, one of the sentences that we're expecting to hear is, I told the truth. Mm-hmm. I, with the first person singular pronoun, told past tense, because it's a past tense event, and they're going to use the word truth. They might add in they didn't lie or they wouldn't lie, et cetera, et cetera, but they are going to tell us, they're going to affirm that they told the truth. In that interview of the 5 minutes and the full transcripts, not once did Charlie Rogers tell us she told the truth. So that's the first thing is if we're going to let her words guide us on what happened, and we go only by, not by the media report, not by what they say police said, but we go by what Charlie Rogers said, there was no crime that took place. She made a list of the words that we expected to hear and the words that were not heard by her. And there's a lot of pictures of all the protests going on and all that, but we expected words like hurt and pain and cut and carve and angry and bad and jail and prison and conviction and finding them. The word for the she spoke 464 words. The word attack was never used. The word truth was never used. The word assault was never used. The word danger was never used. The word pain was never used. The word cut was never used. The word violated was never used. The word blood in any form was not used. The word arrest was not used. The word violent was not used. The word pain was not used. The word cruel was not used. She did use the word pawn 3 times, the word agenda 2 times, the word people 8 times, the word person 2 times. So in a violent sadistic crime, we were expecting her to linguistically tie herself to what happened and let the experiential memory tell us what happened. Not once did she ever affirm that she had been attacked.
Mm-hmm.
Next.
Very interesting.
In fact, it's a way that we follow to find out whether someone is telling the truth or not. She never said that she had been attacked. She never said that she was a victim. She never said that she was a survivor. She said words like, being a victim in a situation like this or a survivor, and there's no pronoun to connect her, and having your integrity questioned, I guess it feels very victimizing again. She's talking about your integrity, not her integrity.
Mm-hmm.
We expect her to tell us what those bastards did to her. We expect to hear that angry language. We expect to hear nothing. Nothing. In fact, what she talked about was hate and agenda and made it sound like planning. And she said her world has been changed by these events, plural, not by this attack. These events.
Mm-hmm. These events.
And, yeah. Then we have one of the biggest clues that she's lying, and this is one that just really is foolproof.
Mm-hmm.
If you have ever been a victim of a crime, or if you've ever been accused of a crime, if you've been a victim of violence, there's a terrible feeling of being out of control, but someone else was literally in control, and it feels as if you've been violated. And if anybody wants to say, hey, that didn't happen to you, there's automatically an angry response that says, oh, yes, it did. You're not calling me a liar.
Right. Yeah, you'd expect some rage.
Sure.
Out of someone who's being questioned like that.
Yes. As a matter of fact, truthful people will not allow for any doubt, especially when it's a personal bodily attack. Mm-hmm. They know what it's like to have the jaw rattled. They know what it's like to have the flesh bruised and buffeted. They know the things, what they feel like. There is no possibility for them to allow someone to doubt them. In fact, if someone doubts them, they will be disgusted at them, but they will not allow for it. What Ms. Rogers said was that she can understand that people may not believe it. She allowed for people to think that maybe it didn't happen. In fact, she never told us that it did happen, but she was able to say, you know, I can understand people not wrapping their heads around it. I can barely wrap my own head around it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Not with that type of thing. Not while those cuts are still healing. Maybe 20 years from now, she could say, well, you know, people could doubt me and I forgive them, but not while those cuts
not
are still...
Way.
Oh, no.
Right. Because it's too real, it's too painful, it's too close.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
She talked about... She never once mentioned, for instance, fear that she had for people in the neighborhood, for other lesbians, for instance. She never had expressed a moment of concern for them with these three dangerous men out there. She said, instead of the focus being on safety and healing and the investigation, so safety first, healing second, and the investigation third, the whole thing's turned into a defense, and it starts to feel like, oh, you know, like, you know, it doesn't even become about the situation. We don't expect someone to tell call a vicious attack an event or a situation. We expect hard language, not the soft, passive type of language. She said the idea of people not believing her, she didn't like, and she even embedded the words, which really I think was kind of surprising to some people. She embedded the words, it's a lie, in her own sentence. She said, it's understandable. I mean, intellectually, I understand that people sort of have a hard time wrapping their heads around the events that happened, as do I. So she who experienced these things herself says she has a hard time accepting it, and I think we should believe her. If she has a hard time accepting it, we should too. But she said, so that the idea that people think it's a lie, it's hurtful. So it's not that these cuts on my stomach hurt. It's that they think it's a lie. Just the idea is hurtful. But within that, we call this an embedded admission, where someone actually uses on their own accord the words, it's a lie, within themselves, not quoting another. Like if I said, you said I did it, that would be me repeating your words. But if I was able to say the words, I did it, within my open statement, it should be a concern that perhaps the person did do it, that you should be on the outlook for that. So as she spoke, over the course of those 5 minutes, and I tip my hat to some of the readership of the blog who picked up right away, they were able to see that she does not use the word I to ever tie herself to an attack. She doesn't use any type of description of what happened. She allows for us to believe that it didn't happen. She's allowing for that. And she gives us no description of even what she's going through now in terms of healing. She shows no concern for the public at large where the three wild men are out there, the three Nazi-like killers. So just within her own statement, and she used a certain passive language, she talked about it starting to feel like a pawn in a game, and she said, that isn't my game, you know. And then she said, this isn't, you know, and stop yourself, which is self-censoring. I didn't ask for this. I didn't want this. So, you know, whatever people's intentions are or not, it's important to me that they understand for myself and future victims, hopefully there'll be none, but they understand. People are people. Agendas are agendas. Now, why is she talking about an agenda instead of a violent crime?
Mm-hmm.
So as it goes, there is, I understand, in that area, there are some rights that are being sought that some claim go well beyond equal rights, and there's going to be some things that are put out in referendum and voting, and she's an outspoken activist in her area. And what she's telling us, what she's told us, is that people have agendas, and I'm a person. These are her words. Mm-hmm. And she feels like a pawn in the game. She's telling us that she has an agenda and that she's part of a larger strategy of which she feels like this is a tactic, and she's got an agenda to do something.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the statement analysis of it. The behavioral analysis, that's something that the police look into. We would look for someone who is just traumatized by the ordeal, who is severely hurt and wounded. One of her friends, this actually rattled me as I did the analysis. One of her friends spoke to the newspaper because she said that she saw what word was written in her basement. I think it said on the wall, "We found you, Dyke." I think that was what it was, which tells us that they were looking for her. So for her to say in the interview that she's not afraid, even though these men were looking for her, that's inconsistent. But when the friend spoke, it was chilling for me because as I was listening to what her friend said and I was working the analysis of what her friend said, I began to get a certain feeling about this friend that I felt that needed also to be shared with law enforcement. Regarding the mutilation of her flesh, this is what she said. Things carved on her body that can only be described as hate, that somebody can only be taught, and we need to stop teaching it. So if your friend, your close friend, had been held down, brutalized, and a knife stuck into her flesh, and her stomach and her flesh were carved into with vicious hate words, and you were asked to describe it, it's hard for me to picture that you would start talking about lectures on hate.
Mm-hmm.
But we listened carefully to her words. She said, she didn't say things that were carved in her flesh. She said things carved on her body. There's a difference between carving in someone's flesh and carving on someone's body. The difference between carving in and carving on told me these wounds are very, very superficial. I have not seen them and have not seen a police report, but this is what the words. If she saw these wounds, she's describing them as being superficial. Then, with no description of blood, stitches, healing, pain medication, itching, anything, she said, we need to stop teaching that type of hate. So she went to an agenda of teaching against hate.
Mm-hmm.
So this was concerning to me, friend's statement. But then she went further. I went further with my analysis, and I said, why did she say we need to stop teaching it?
Mm-hmm.
Why is there a we in unity between herself and Charlie?
And right.
And now
that's
I have to wonder. Yeah. Well, when you play chess, and I'm a chess player, a pawn is the weakest piece, and the pawn is often sacrificed for a larger strategy for an ultimate ending. But someone pointed out to me in analysis, don't forget that chess is not played by a single piece. And did she have help? Yeah, I forgot to mention one thing, which is fascinating. It's not part of the scan technique of analysis, but Mark McClish is a retired federal marshal and a statement analyst. He did a mini mountain of research on the number three. And what he found was that when a person was in a position to fabricate reality, to make up a lie, and they had to choose a number, they often chose the number three. The only time when the liar chose a different number is when a cop pulled over someone and asked them if they were drinking, and the answer would be, no, officer, I've only had two drinks or two beers. That's the most common response. But what he said was, in his research, that when the number three is mentioned, it doesn't mean someone is lying. It means the analyst should red flag it to find out. It is possible for three men to commit a crime at 3 o'clock on the third floor of Third Street. It's certainly possible.
Mm-hmm.
But when we hear the word three, we simply flag it just to question it and say, well, let's make sure that we're not dealing with the liar's number. That's what he calls it, the liar's number. But in my own work, and I've conducted more than 2,600 interviews over the years, the number three I have found creeps into people's language. When David Hartley, the jet skier from Texas, went missing, the wife
yes.
on television crying, just had three boats chasing us. That's all you had, just had three boats. That's the number she immediately chose to, and she was lying as well. She was not being truthful about what happened with that case. But it's interesting that the research showed that this number three comes up for people that are fabricating. Well, in her case, she chose three men to be masked, unable to identify them. Police told one journalist that, this may be off the record, but that beyond saying they were three males, she either could not or refused to even give any description further about race, language, or anything, which is highly, highly unusual.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't think this is all weird enough, it gets a little weirder. Nowhere could I find anyone reporting the questioning of this. And the reason being is simple. It's a political hot potato. No crime reports on it anywhere, no crime analysis, because people are afraid that if I question it, I will be called a homophobe. So what I found and others found was on homosexual websites, they were questioning whether it was true or not, and they were making excellent arguments about the videotape appearance and about the language that she chose. And they were doing so without fear of being called homophobe themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, it was the gay and lesbian websites that were unafraid to criticize or at least question, whereas other places, and we see this, it's really kind of an interesting thing today, is when a newspaper has an article out, they have a section for comments, and what we'll find is, you know, maybe 15 or 20 comments in a row pouring out support, and where can I send my money, and one person saying, I think we better find out if this happened already, if it's real or not, and then a barrage of, you're a hate monger, you're a Nazi, you're a horrible person, it has nothing to do with that. In fact, statement analysis doesn't care whether someone is any sexual orientation or their race or their nationality or background. It's taught in every language. It's taught in every nation, you know, basically every nation. It is an issue not to me as the analyst. It was an issue to Charlie Rogers because she used the word agenda. I didn't use the word agenda. She did.
Right.
I didn't use the word pawn. She did. I didn't use any of those type of descriptions. In fact, I described the crime from the police report through media's lens as Nazi-like, horrific, barbaric, brutal. We also learned that she, when she got out of the house, they poured gasoline everywhere and then lit it on fire. The police said there was only $200 worth of damage done in the home. That's kind of strange.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the things. So
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, no, you better comment now because I'm going to take the story a little bit weirder for the next step.
Okay. Okay. Well, let me just say that we've got quite the chat room going here, and one of our guests, Hobnob, brings up a very interesting point, and I just had to run this by you. Hobnob says, what is interesting is that in hate crimes, the perps usually target the face so as to send a visible message and also to remind the victim. Every time they look in the mirror, they see the scars. On her arms and stomach are places easily reached and also easily covered.
I think that's an excellent
point. That?
Yeah, I think
yeah,
that's an excellent point.
Good point, Hobnob. Thank you.
Yeah, and someone else had pointed out that men don't seem to have the same problem with lesbianism as they do with homosexuality, gay men. that type of thing. It's just not, I don't know if this is regional in the different places that I've lived, but there's just not this overwhelming hatred of lesbians by men. And my own thinking would have been, if this had been a true hate crime, as she said, they would have targeted her face. They would have sent that message, that strong and powerful message. But I think it's an excellent point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's go on to where you were going to take us next.
You have your seatbelt fastened for this one?
Pardon me?
You have to fasten your seatbelt for this one.
Okay, we'll fasten our seatbelts.
Charlie Rogers was a Nebraska Husky basketball player. And apparently she was quite a star. I don't follow women's basketball, but she was quite a star. And she's 33 years old now, so it would have been 10, 11 years ago that she was a star there, renowned for shot blocking and that sort of thing. Yeah, she was something else. She had a professor there, Professor Kerry Dunn. And Kerry Dunn was giving a lecture on hate and how she hates hate and has to stop hate and everyone hates. And she was showing support for a lesbian victim of a hate crime, she said. She had recently converted to Judaism. And when she got out to her car, after speaking at a free speech rally about hate, her front window was shattered, her tires were slashed, and the body of her vehicle was spray-painted with kike, whore, nigger lover, shut up, bitch, and a swastika, covering the gamut of hate crimes. So they had the race issue, they had anti-Semitism, Nazism, and anti-lesbianism, all spray-painted on her car as she came out to the car. And I think it followed a similar pattern where she agreed to make this report to the police, and the police brought in the federal investigators of the hate crime. The professor agreed to speak to them. And two witnesses came forward to say that they saw her spray painting this on her car herself. She was arrested, indicted, went to trial, and was found guilty and sentenced, I think, 2 years in prison for it. Her name was Kerry Dunn, Professor Kerry Dunn. She spent 2 years in prison for this. While she was in prison, she continued to write on ethics, of all things.
Oh, yeah.
So, and in fact, when that happened, the school closed down. I think some of the surrounding schools closed down. They had candlelight vigils. They had rallies. They had protests with people carrying signs and walking in circles and down with whatever they're down with. And so it was a similar response that she allowed to turn into a big event. And she spent 2 years in prison for it from the same college that Charlie Rogers was a basketball star at just a few years prior. So I can't help but wonder if there's a connection there.
Mm-hmm.
Also noting that not only did Ms. Rogers give this report to the local police, but she gave it to the federal investigators as well. So I think that when I said the lawyer has withheld the money from the fundraising, and you said, I think the lawyer made a smart move because I think the lawyer may end up needing that money for a defense fund for her. The difference being is that they had two witnesses that came forward to testify. We saw her spray paint this herself. In this particular case, they may conclude forensically that this was not inflicted by someone else, or if it was done very gently, and that there's no proof. As a matter of fact, one of the things police did say was she said they stormed into her house and broke into her house. There was no sign of forced entry anywhere. That was one of the things that was suspicious to them. The fact that they went down to her basement, had time to spray paint on her walls, we found you, as if they were searching for her, and that she had only $200 of damage from gasoline being poured in the home and lit on fire. That really made people's heads turn. But I think more than anything else, people looked at the video and said, where are the scars, the bleeding? You know, she was that terribly beat up. Why is she sitting up so comfortably and looking like that? She's in good shape. So it's really fascinating to me that literally tens of thousands of people can rally to her support politicians can use her. The mayor of Lincoln used her name and evoked her name, and he's looking to get votes with that. People of all different backgrounds, of different levels of intelligence, some people of much higher education than not, thousands upon thousands of people, and then across the country, readers sending in money and wanting to donate.
Yeah.
And here we are saying, where is the discernment? You know, have we become so dumbed down that have we become the Casey Anthony jury that we're not thinking things through? We have lawyers who can't follow arguments, who believe that their only job is to get the criminal off. And instead of, once upon a time in our country, a lawyer was there to protect his client against malicious prosecution, but to get to the truth, everything's become a game now. And it just feels like we're not a sober-minded, discerning culture any longer. And it makes me wonder, how is it that people would not question just instinctively, hey, where is the statement I'm telling the truth? Where is the description of, you know, if you've ever heard Holocaust survivors give testimony on like the History Channel, even years later, the sensory descriptions are sometimes only one or two words, and then boom, the emotion just overtakes them. Even after 50, 60 years, there is still that memory working that's evident in their speech. And
right.
They go back to things. So,
right,
it's like
exactly.
The, you know,
and, yeah, go ahead. Well, I just wanted to remind... Go ahead.
let's go to Denny.
Yeah. Oh, no. No.
When memory plays with us, we can instantly be transported back 20, 30, 40 years in our lives by a smell, by a certain food taste.
Exactly. It's happened to everybody. Just recently that happened to me, and it exactly that. It was a song. It was somebody singing a song in the store, and I thought, oh, my gosh, that's a song. In fact, my dad used to sing, and it sounded just like that, and these memories came flooding back. Exactly.
People will hear a Michael Jackson tune, and they'll transport themselves back to the 80s. I don't know what happened in the 80s, but they go back there. They don't think about him as a pedophile or the drug addict or anything like that. They're thinking about themselves back in the 80s, what they were doing. I see Bing Crosby and Bob Hope on television. I instantly think about my parents and how my parents went to go see him and how he was 80 years old still doing stand-up comedy. You know, it brings me back. Yeah. So we all have that. It's an indication of truth when someone speaks, and we expect to hear that. I have cases where I investigate recently several cases of rape that what I look for is not only am I listening acutely to the pronouns, but I'm listening for a sensory description to show me that memory is in play. And when someone says, for example, he raped me and then we drove home, and they're able to use the word we, which represents unity, no rape victim will use the word we between herself and the disgust she feels over that animal. It doesn't exist. And when I hear the word we, I know it's time to pack up and go home and call in a therapist, because we have a problem. We have a false report.
Peter, let me just interject right here, because our chat room is just buzzing here, and we've got such great comments, such great guests tonight. I just wanted to reiterate our number for call-in is 1-646-478-0982. So come on, guys, grab a cup of coffee and get on the phone. We'd like to hear from you. Okay. That's all I wanted to say. Go ahead, Peter.
It's a question from the chat room that people have. Be glad to take any of the questions.
I will definitely pass them on. They're just making some great comments, not any real questions yet, but just some terrific comments. So come on, guys. Give us a call.
as a society, we can't be afraid to speak our opinion. In fact, when someone expresses an opinion and there's a response that I'm going to sue you for not believing me, generally speaking, the truthful people feel no such compulsion. There's a distance between a victim of crime and a doubter, that the two just don't meet. So when someone has been, for instance, if someone was sexually abused and they meet someone who doesn't believe they were sexually abused, there's a bitterness there. There's no we between them. There's a certain defensive posture. I think it reminds me of the Solomonic wisdom of the righteous are as bold as a lion. There's a certain confidence that a truthful person has that stays with them. And so we as society, we cannot be afraid to give an opinion just because of sensitivity about race or sexual orientation or anything else. Truth is truth and deception is deception wherever it is found. And I really feel strongly about this, that the journalists in Lincoln have not done a favor to the community of not pursuing this. There's more to this story. When a journalist says, I call the police and they're not giving me any information. Dig. Look at the New York City media, what they did with Representative Anthony Weiner when he said that someone hacked into his account. They sent me, his office sent me kind of a threatening, you better stop with your analysis. And I said, sure, I'll stop my analysis. Just tell me that I'm wrong, which they didn't do, of course. And his own words showed that he was being deceptive, and, of course, that came out. But he was hounded by the media because they smelled blood. They smelled deception, and that's what they do. They go after it, and they keep on asking questions, and they challenge him. So when he said, my account was hacked, they said, how do you know your account was hacked? Who hacked your account? Mm-hmm. When did you find out your account was hacked? And they barraged him with questions where he tried to, his first answer was, how do I know my account is hacked? Let me go about my business and serve the people. He changed the subject. And then one of the media reporters said to him, hey, on your blog, you wrote that the Supreme Court Justice, Clarence Thomas, uses the same strategy where he refuses to answer questions and change the subject. Isn't that what you're doing now? So they're driven. They ask the questions. They follow. They get answers. I am appalled at the lack of coverage this case has had. I'm appalled at some of the most simple cases that we've had that CrimeWire has covered and touched upon. Baby Lisa case. I understand they were very close to having a confession. The hotshot lawyer shows up from New York City, and right away the prosecuting attorneys cave in and throw in the towel. And they tell the police, well, we need more. Go find the body. They had everything. It was a open and shut case, very simple case. Baby Isla here in Maine.
Amazing.
This was another case that was really simple. 7-8 months later, there is still no arrest. There's got to be an element of courage. I don't know if it is a lack of confidence in our jury system because we've all been undermined by what happened in the Casey Anthony jury, but there's got to be an element. A guy calls up giggling on the phone that his daughter's been kidnapped. They know Sergio did something to his daughter and that his daughter's not alive. And they're both complicit in whatever's going on. No arrest. Once upon a time, police officers were revered in our country. They would make an arrest, even if it meant on a traffic ticket, bring someone in and get it a confession and get to truth. We need skilled investigators. We don't need bullies. We don't need brutes. We get far more information by asking open-ended questions and carefully listening to the answers than we do at screaming at somebody. So we're seeing a lack of confidence that the nation has in law enforcement. Baby Lisa, Baby Isla. There's been a number of these type of cases. Haley Dunn in Texas, 13-year-old went missing 2 years ago. We've got a lying mother, and we've got a boyfriend with tons of child pornography. They're still walking free. Drugs, violence, child pornography, bloodlust videos, failed polygraph.
Right.
No arrests? Are you kidding? So we have that. I think there's a feeling, especially with the internet being so information flying so quickly, that people are looking at these things and they're going, "Wow, these are not masterminds. the FBI was in the baby visa case. I thought they were supposed to be really smart, and I thought they were supposed to know everything, and yet they are letting us down on case after case. So I think it's hard for the public to see these things. And I was hoping Denny could kind of address it today a little bit, and perhaps when he's back on, about what's happening to the confidence that we once had just a generation ago in our law enforcement that just doesn't appear to be there today.
No, I think, well, I've got my own opinions about that. But let me tell you, we have a question for you from Miss Lemon in the chat room, and she asked, Peter, what would you ask Charlie Rogers if you could talk to her? What would you ask her?
That's a great question. I don't know.
It is.
I think that she's told me all I need to know. The perfect question to ask, given the opportunity, is what happened? What happened next? And then, as those are the two natural questions that can really get anything out of someone, when the person answers that question, what we do is we don't ask anything unless they offer the information first. We do our just almost like a rule that I can't bring something up. And like someone will say, well, I had lunch. I said, well, I would say, what did you have for lunch? What, do you want to know every detail? Yeah, please tell me a detail. You know, I had roast beef. What else did you have? You got to be kidding me. And what happens is someone begins to speak. There was a case where money was stolen. A safe was actually missing. And someone blabbed and went on and on with no answer. And all the guy wouldn't talk about the safe, but he wouldn't shut up about his favorite fishing hole. And the detective went down and woke up in the middle of the night and said, my word, call everyone down to the fishing hole. They lowered into the fishing hole, and there it was. The safe was there. The meaning is that people's words will betray them. When everyone was looking for Kaylee Anthony, Cindy Anthony went to the microphone and said, we don't want Texas Equus Search around here because we don't believe Casey's in the woods or anything. Nobody asked you, Cindy, if Kaylee was in the woods. Thank you for telling us in the woods. She introduced that to us. Now we go into the woods. Yeah. And she showed guilty knowledge of that, and she showed the ability to lie on under oath. That's why listening to what the response is and then asking questions off that response is critical.
Very interesting. Peter, we do have a caller on the line, a guest from the chat room. Hobnob is on the line. Hobnob, welcome to CrimeWire, and thank you for calling in.
Hi, honeys. How y'all doing?
We're doing great.
Oh, thank you. Not too bad. It's nearly 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm wide-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Oh,
I'm used to this sort of time anyway. Peter, have you thought about asking her to come on and do a show with you?
I have, and I would do it in a heartbeat. I don't think that her lawyer would allow it. They're obviously well aware of the analysis, as is the local journalist there on the ground in Lincoln, and the law enforcement. So I don't think she would. I would love that. It would be really interesting just to ask her, hey, tell our listeners, this is what happened. Take us through it. And Hobnob, we have to know that with the audience, Crime Wire, or with the statement analysis show, people are going to catch on to what she says. Now, I recently invited Lance DiPietro on the show, Justin DiPietro's mafia wannabe, Sopranos wannabe brother, one that to shoot up people with baseball bats. He refused to come on the show, but I asked him anyway, and then he said that he wanted to meet me. He was looking very forward to meeting me face-to-face, and I, of course, thought I'd be glad to do so, but you'll have to know I'm a little bit bigger than Davy Island, so you'll have to take that into consideration.
And, of course, he'd have to bring his mom as well so he can hide behind the legs while saying, I'm going to set my mom on you.
Sort
of bullying stuff.
Yeah, she knows the case
well. Because I was wondering, I got to thinking whether it would be actually worth me doing an open letter to her and then sort of like passing it around the internet.
Yeah, I think that would be wonderful. I would do a show in a heartbeat. I could schedule it in just under an hour, whatever it would take. But I would be glad to do that. I got to tell you,
Hobnob, that's a great idea.
Because I'm thinking, yeah, if she's not going to talk to the public, if she's sort of like quietly disappeared off, she's got to be. She will be looking to see what responses that she's getting to her story. You know, it's like it's all about her. So therefore, she's going to be Googling and seeing who's saying what about her and all the rest of it, testing the waters because she likes the attention, be it good or bad. So I got to thinking, perhaps, you know, open letters, because she's going to find them, she's going to read them, and they're going to be passed on to her, and
yeah,
try and get her that way to talk.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. When someone tells me that they think that celebrities don't Google what's going on in the internet world, they do. Whether someone is a new celebrity by something infamous like this, or someone is a big shot celebrity, they all do it.
Everybody Googles their name to see what's going on. You know, if they've done something in the local community, or they've won a prize, or they've just done something really, really dumb, you know, or just a mention, or anybody who's got the same name as them, you know, they want to see, you know, oh, I wonder if they're related, you know, what do they look like, and all the rest of it.
Sure.
Yeah, so she'll be checking the internet to see, you know, see what's what.
And I think that she's, obviously it's a crime to make a false report, and that's something that they would be dealing with. But I also think that, and this is my own opinion, is that something is terribly wrong in her life, that she would seek out this type of negative attention and have a need, especially if she was being a basketball star. She was used to being in the spotlight. And
exactly. So, you know, that makes me wonder, was she living in the house on her own, was she living with somebody, or was she in a relationship that's suddenly gone bosoms up? And now to make her feel worth something.
Yeah, it's a great point. There's some stressor that triggered this, that took place.
That's a great point. And someone had, and Hobnob, maybe it was you, said whatever kicked this off with her was a major break in her life.
Yeah.
And
it would obviously have been fairly recent. It's a case of like, look at me, I've been hurt, you know, this is what you've done
right.
to me. If you'd been here, I wouldn't have been hurt, and blah, 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 you know, the usual sort of stuff. So, what I'll do is I'll pen a letter, and then I'll put it on the blog, on Peter's blog, and
then I'll
look for sort of comments and stuff, or I'll email it in and look for comments and corrections of my typos, for which I am renowned.
And
they're very fluent in Hobnob.
I think people would find that they're very, very respectful and very polite to her, and the public asking her questions.
Yeah.
I think that she would find that
it's not going to be like out and out accusing her, but it's going to be a case of like, we know that you've told Porky's. You know, now if you want to sort of keep your standing in like the community, you know, now is the time to come forward and say, okay, I lied, or I misspoke, which is another popular one. And then seek forgiveness and help, and you know, so that people in the future who are victims of hate are going to be believed, rather than like everybody going, oh, look, there's another one.
Right.
So it's going
to
be...
Go ahead.
Won't be aggressive, but it'll be quite passive, and like sort of like
she
getting
would.
Her by the hand and leading her and saying, look, it's okay to tell everybody, you know, the truth.
It's
you know,
right.
We won't judge you because you've decided to come, you know, to tell the truth. We're very forgiving about things like that. Obviously, there's a problem somewhere, you know, and we're quite understanding of that. But as long as you continue to tell, like, fibs, then, you know, you're going to have big problems.
Another person in our chat room, Equinox, did comment about her coming forward, and this person had written, it was only one online newspaper who in one line questioned whether her story was true. She went on TV so she was already reaching the online news.
It's like the gay community are coming out and sort of like asking questions about it because they can't be accused of sort of hate mongering because they're gay and whatever else, you know, so... We need to sort of like get the mainstream media to sort of say, look, stop being so politically correct. You know, if someone's telling lies and you know, they're telling a dodgy story, you've got to come up and do something about it because otherwise people are just going to not believe anything that anybody ever says.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got to be sort of like stand up and be proper journalists.
Right. And I have to tell
you guys...
Because
otherwise you're not going to get any news at all because nobody will say anything for fear of upsetting somebody somewhere.
Exactly. And I have to tell you, Peter, and I hope you guys can hear me okay, because we just ran out of time. And so we're off air. So I'm going to say goodnight. And Hobnob, thank you so much for calling in. And
you're welcome.
You can blame the
chat room.
Love it.
We'll have to Skype one night so we can have a good long chat and not worry about phone bills and stuff, and we can talk about anything and everything.
Because
I'm always available on Skype, Yahoo, and MSN, and whatever else.
Yeah, you just come on to our CrimeWire site and leave me your information, and I'd be happy to. You're wonderful.
Super job. Super job. Okay. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you all.
Well, thank you.
Have a great
night. You too. And
right,
good night,
take
Peter.
Care.
Yep. Okay, good night, darling.
Take care, honey. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. That's it for tonight. Wow, what an interesting show. I want to thank our guest, Peter Hyatt. Fascinating. Thank you for joining us on CrimeWire. We always support and value you guests. If you would like to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com or hear a rebrush tonight show, go to www.crimewire.blog.com. Turn on your computer and the show will automatically play. Remember, your voices will be heard where else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewire.com. God bless from the time CrimeWire, Danny Griffin, and Sophie Milano. And I thank you all. And good night and God bless.